Hello and welcome to Frame to Frame. I'm Andy Williams.
I'm Sean Wilson.
And we're coming to you tonight to discuss films that have been influenced by Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. So now, for those that are new to listening to us, hello, welcome. We discuss films that are linked together by a very specific theme. So some of the themes that we've done in the past have been our personal comfort food movies, because what with everything going on at the moment, we wanted to revert to type and have some comfort food in the form of entertainment. We've done some of the movies that represented the media that were released in 1976. So they would be sort of Network, All the President's Men. We've done all sorts of mock rock docs. World War II Through the Eyes of Children was last week's episode. So this week, we're going to be focusing on films that have been influenced by Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And as announced on our Twitter page, the two films that we're going to be focusing on will be Coraline and The Matrix. So, Sean, I'm sure you're aware we could have chosen a number of films. Why was it these two that you think we settled upon?
Well, I think in the case of Coraline, it's the fantastical element of it and the sense that it's based on a source by Neil Gaiman, and Neil Gaiman has got a love of fairy tales and nonsense literature. And certainly when you look at director Henry Selick's interpretation of Coraline, it's very, very faithful to that nightmarish, twisted, surreal world that Lewis Carroll spins. Well, we can get more into that. And then with The Matrix is even more upfront. The Matrix actually name drops Alice in Wonderland, Alice through the rabbit hole, when Morpheus, mm-hmm. Lawrence Fishburne talks to Neo, Keanu Reeves, prior to Neo having the reality of the situation put in front of him.
Before he jumps down said rabbit hole.
Exactly.
He has the choice of the red pill or the blue pill.
Yeah. And I think that it's interesting how much Alice in Wonderland has actually infiltrated popular culture. You wouldn't necessarily think that a great big sci-fi blockbuster like The Matrix would channel that. But then The Matrix channels a whole host of different things: philosophies, religion, spirituality, martial arts, Hong Kong cinema. Is all kind of put in a blender along with Alice in Wonderland. Whereas Coraline, I know one imagines Coraline could have been a story that Lewis Carroll might have written were he still alive. I think certainly the level of menace in it is very, very amped up from what Lewis Carroll would have undertaken. Not to mention the fact that I think it's important to say that Coraline is a narrative-driven story, whereas Alice in Wonderland was almost a kind of stream of consciousness, again, like nonsense literature.
Yeah. That's what Carroll was pretty famous for, wasn't it? That's what he did, was nonsense literature. So you've mentioned the work of Neil Gaiman, who, as you mentioned, wrote the book of Coraline. I understand you're quite a big Neil Gaiman reader, is that correct?
Not massively. I've read American Gods, and I thought it was interesting. The idea of Norse gods being at loose in contemporary American culture, I thought was interesting. I mean, I'm more aware of Neil Gaiman stuff than it's the case that I've read them. I mean, Neverwhere, Good Omens, which is obviously turned into the TV series of Michael Sheen and David Tennant. I'm more familiar with his approach rather than the ins and outs of the stories themselves.
Okay.
But he's clearly, he's obviously got a love of surreal humour and very, very nightmarish imagery. And I think clearly in a lot of his stories, there is a kind of coming of age element, which again applies to Alice in Wonderland, that sense of the central character coming to some kind of emotional awakening. And I think it's not a surprise that Gaiman would find inspiration in Carol in that sense.
Yeah, well, I thought you were a bigger fan than that. That's why I was quite surprised.
Sorry, but to disappoint you.
Yeah, well, I'm used to it by now. So in terms of where I sit on this, I've read quite a bit of Neil Gaiman, I guess. Not his entire oeuvre, to use a better word.
Good
but
word.
Thank you. Not his entire back catalogue, but so he picked up a comic run that Alan Moore wrote called Marvel Man, but it's now released as Miracle Man for rights reasons. Alan Moore wrote a run and then Neil Gaiman wrote after that. So I've read that run. He wrote Sandman, which is sort of like his seminal comic work. So I've read some of those. Good Omens, which he co-wrote with Terry Pratchett. And that's where I am at the moment. I still haven't read Coraline, interestingly.
It's interesting.
Although
I haven't read it either. And I think one imagines, based on the reviews that Coraline got, it's pretty faithful to the book. One imagines reading the reviews of it.
Well, my wife has actually taught it to a class of year sevens. So I was sort of asking her this question ahead of recording this podcast. And she said it is very, very faithful. So that's, I mean, it's interesting that Henry Selick, a director who's, you know, famed for stop motion animation. He did Nightmare Before Christmas. He did James and the Giant Peach. And he moved to Leica Studios to do such, like, he seems to really have a grasp of what's dark, but what works for a younger age group as well. And I think that is possibly the perfect marriage for Coraline, being gamer's material and Selick's sensibilities. So as I was rewatching Coraline, I did have a few sort of ideas bouncing around with how similar to Alice in Wonderland it is, but also where it contrasts. So I'm just going to run some of these by you and see what you thought. So at the beginning, when Coraline is sort of wandering around trying to find something to do, she's bored on a rainy day. Now, this tonally contrasts with Alice lazing in a tree on her summer day, falling asleep. It also contrasts where Alice is being taught by somebody. So Alice has the full attention of one person, whereas Coraline is looking for exactly that. How do you think those comparisons and contrasts fit? Do you think that's a fair thing to say?
I think it is a fair comparison as well. And also what you have is the idea, I think, that in Alice in Wonderland and Coraline, the central characters are desiring some kind of escape from maybe from the mundanity of modern life. In the case of Coraline, what you get is the central character voiced by Dakota Fanning discovers the door in her house, which takes her on a very Alice-like sort of rabbit hole through to another dimension with her other mother, who in both iterations is voiced by Terry Hatcher brilliantly, I would say. And yes, the idea is that superficially, almost like in Alice in Wonderland, superficially, outwardly, everything appears to be quite magical, and it appears to be the superficial answer to the banality of everyday life. The fact that the other mother has buttons instead of eyes, but it doesn't matter because she can conjure up fantastical meals. Yes. And
but something that Coraline was looking for in the normal, quote unquote, normal world. She was complaining about the slop that she gets served. So
yeah,
again, that's another contrast between the Wonderland, as it were, and the real world.
Yeah, and I think that also, isn't that interesting, though, that the fact that there is that dinner scene in the other realm in Coraline, and Alice in Wonderland at one point with the Mad Hatter centers around the Mad Hatter's dinner party. There is this idea of the congregation, which might be a similarity between the two. The idea that what you're looking at in both the other realm in Coraline and in Alice in Wonderland is something that is clearly fantastical, but in which you can recognize very human impulses and very kind of human motivations, which I think is brilliant. There is that psychology under it. And the idea is that in Coraline, she thinks that an escape into this other realm with her other parents who don't have eyes but who have buttons for eyes is going to basically, you know, give her the life that she doesn't have with her apparently bland normal parents. And then she realizes eventually that there is no substitute for real life. There is no, you know, no matter what you think of your parents, there is no substitute for parents who actually love you, regardless of whether they express it or not. And likewise, in Alice in Wonderland, you get this kind of nightmarish descent into almost into a fantasy world that reveals a kind of like darker side to it. If you think in Alice in Wonderland, for example, with the Red Queen.
Again, that was going to be something I'd touch upon, which was the evil female ruling overlord of the Wonderlands. So you have her other mother, who sort of descends into that ruling overlord of the other world, versus the the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland. You also mentioned the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. One of the things that I picked up on when I was watching it this time was that, similar to Alice in Wonderland, Coraline has two eccentric side characters. Yes. That the first thing they do is talk about tea. Brilliantly voiced, I might add, by French and Saunders. I think that's a very clear nod to the Mad Hatter. Might just be me overthinking things, which is quite possible. But I did very much think that was deliberate, as well as the fact that she talks to a cat as a sidekick.
Yeah, and the fact that the cat, almost like the white rabbit in Alice in Wonderland, which appears to be able to jump between Alice's ordinary world and the underworld, the cat can walk backwards and forwards between these two different realms, and it's almost the, no pun intended, the catalyst for what happens.
You're better than that.
I'm not. and it's, I think there are a lot of comparisons. I mean, the most obvious comparison being that worm-like link between the small door in Coraline's normal house and the door in the wall of the other house. And it's clearly very, very Alice in Wonderland, like the way that that is designed and the way that's also shot by Henry Selick as well. There are a lot of interesting comparisons to be made, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, it'd be great to see Henry Selick do a few more films, from being completely honest, because he hasn't done a whole host of them, but as we've mentioned, the ones that he has done all seem to have had something interesting about them, even the ones we haven't mentioned, like, you know, Moon Girl and Monkey Bone and stuff like that. So it would be nice, but obviously stop motion takes its time. I've long been hoping for a sequel to Wallace and Gromit's Curse of the Were-Rabbit, but, you know, animation takes time, especially stop motion animation. But going back to Coraline, so at the time it didn't really light up the box office. I think it did sort of average numbers. Why do you think that would be?
I mean, having watched it again recently for the first time since it came out, it's a challenging watch. I mean, it is a kids' film, but I think maybe it's kind of difficult to ascertain what age of child it's for, because it is twisted and the imagery is very, very dark, and it's not a cozy movie, which I think is entirely to its credit. It's not a cuddly movie. Not even at the end, where you might expect, you know, you might expect it to be kind of dark and prickly all the way through, and then to have this kind of like treacly sanctimonious ending. It isn't really like that. It never really falls into that. And the creepy moments are genuinely creepier. The idea that in order to be sealed permanently in the other realm, her other mother has to sew buttons onto her eyes as replacements is a very, very brilliantly twisted.
That's
image.
Very dark.
It is, and one must credit Neil Gaiman for that. I also think, and this won't be a surprise to you or to people who've listened to any of the other episodes, the score is very, very important. I think it's pivotal.
You don't say.
Actually, yeah, it's the relationship between music and the image in this film is really, really important, because I looked up the score, the making of the score by Bruno Coulet, French composer. And the idea is that you have the opening theme in particular they are nonsense lyrics sung by, apparently, looking it up, the Children's Choir of Nice. There is another connection with Alice in Wonderland right there. You have vocals being used in a very, very interesting way in the score, but also there is, within certain scenes in the film, there is a relationship between the music that you're hearing and the imagery. There is one scene where she's in the other realm and then she goes out into the garden and there are flowers sort of coming into life and lighting up and kind of mixing with bass lines and brass and everything. And it's very clever. It's got that very kind of eerie, unsettling vibe to it, and I think the music is kind of pivotal for us, you know, ensuring that the film doesn't become sentimental or cozy. Maybe that might be why it struggled to find an audience. Maybe it was slightly too challenging for its intended target audience.
I get that. I watched it with half an eye as to whether I should be showing it to my eldest child, and there wasn't any specific thing within the film where I thought, no, that he wouldn't be able to handle that. It was more the unsettling tone of the whole thing. It was an odd shots here and there that would be very creepy. And do you know what I mean? It's not, whereas with, for example, let's just pick Alien, because it's the first film that comes to my head. There's very clear scenes that you can't see in Alien, whereas there isn't that with Coraline. But it's just the overall sense of unease that wouldn't strike particularly good chord with younger children, I don't feel. But, I mean, it worked as an older member of an audience. It worked for me. It was creepy, and I think it did exactly what it needed to do.
I mean, I think it's interesting, given that it was the first feature film that Leica did. I am right about that, is it was the first film that they feature film that they put out, as I understand it. And
you're putting me on the spot now.
I think it was.
I think they did. So I think they did a short film with Henry Selick, and then Coraline was the first feature length film. But I'm going to check that now
The point that I was making was that in comparison to the later Leica films, I think that certainly the design of Coraline, the design of the characters in particular, strikes much more of a horrific note. I think certainly as Leica's films have gone on, I think there's perhaps been, and I love Leica, I'm not criticising Leica at all, I think they do a brilliant job. I think there is maybe a bit more of a wholesome quality in their later films, whereas there's definitely a creepier edge to this one.
Yeah, so just to let you know, I was correct in what I said. So that makes me quite happy. But if you're looking at Coraline and the latest film, which would be Missing Link, I think you're absolutely correct. They've moved very, very, very much towards the mainstream with that one. I didn't like it that much.
I have to say, I didn't watch it. I didn't see it. I do want to see it. I do intend to catch up with it. But I mean, I suppose,
without being too much of an advert for Netflix, Missing Link is available on Netflix for anybody that wants to see it.
But there is, I mean, they did do the Box Trolls, and the Box Trolls actually had a very morbid kind of macabre feel to it. And the Box Trolls had a wonderful kind of like grubbiness to it. It wasn't scary necessarily, but it was kind of like,
that's exactly the right word.
Yeah, in a good way. I don't mean that in a bad way.
Absolutely. I completely understand where, because like I say, having seen the film, I was trying to think of the perfect adjective for it, and that would be it.
Yeah, it's
grubby, just unwashed, and
yeah. I mean, you're dealing with a group of a human boy who's been brought up by a group of like sewer dwelling trolls, and then you've got a villain brilliantly voiced by Ben Kingsley who's allergic to cheese and who keeps insisting on eating cheese. And there's a kind of. I mean, maybe out of all the Leica films, maybe that is the one that owes the clearest debt to Coraline in terms of like, oh, this is genuinely quite odd. And I can't quite put my finger on it.
Yeah, I mean, they've got Paranorman, which was sort of sandwiched in between those two.
See, I loved Paranorman. I thought Paranorman was brilliant.
Great. I mean, they were on course to be the next Pixar, and they still kind of are to an extent. In the hit rates that they've had, you know, we're talking Coraline, Paranorman, The Box Trolls, Kubo and the Two Strings, which was just astounding.
Yeah.
And Missing Link. So, you know, everyone's allowed a slight off day. But in terms of a hit rate, that's a pretty high success rate. So, and something that you'd have to look at the early days of Pixar, and they went, 10 years, even more, without making, I mean, arguably Cars is their first not great film. But even a not great Pixar film is still pretty good.
I mean, it could be worse. So, it could be Cars 2.
not talk about that. No, Monsters University.
Yeah.
But that's a conversation for another day. But yes, Coraline. So I think that the film hits all of the right notes that it needed to. It was scary and kind of like the right amount of heartfelt, in that it had the message that you mentioned about one's parents being, you can't have any replacement for parents that love you, even if they do cook better meals. but so it has that in there, but it also has the creepiness and the weirdness, and it doesn't shove it down your throat. Would you be, I'm guessing the answer to this, but I want to hear you say it. Would you recommend this for people to watch?
Yeah, I would. I think maybe there is slightly more appeal for adults. I mean, I suppose, well, actually, I'll throw the question back at you, actually. I mean, given this draws on, given that this draws on a lot of the nightmarish qualities of Alice in Wonderland, who would you say that Alice in Wonderland is aimed at? Necessarily, would you say that Alice in Wonderland is aimed at children, or would you say that adults would get more out of the kind of linguistic atmosphere and nuances of it?
I think that for Alice, you'd have to look at an older child. So by that, you'd be talking probably about eight to ten. So not quite old enough for like Marvel movies or Star Wars, but older than, you know, some of the more basic kid-friendly films. So hopefully outgrown Paw Patrol by that point, because that's a day I can't wait for.
The day you get Paw Patrol replaced with Coraline endlessly, your brain is going to be scrambled.
You know what? If I have to watch Mighty Pups one more time, I'll take Coraline at this point. But yeah, I think that it's definitely an older kid's sort of film that they... It's about coming to terms with who you are as a person, and that's something that you become a bit more aware of, I feel, when you're coming to the end of your primary school years. So yeah, that would be the time I'd sort of recommend it to introduce to people. So Coraline, I think we're both massively thumbs up on it as a film. We'd recommend it to older people, definitely. Tentatively to those with kids. But now we're going to move to one of the largest blockbusters of 1999. Yes, 21 years ago, which seems nuts.
Makes me feel old. Makes me feel really old.
I mean, I don't remember it coming out. I only ever watched it in retrospect, although I did.
You're making me feel older.
I did own it on VHS. So, you know, there was swings and roundabouts. But
I've got the DVD here next to me, and it's got the old 15 certificate, the chunky 15 certificate logo on it. Like
I have the same DVD now. But it's nuts. It's held up so well. And even like visually, the effects have held up so well. But looking at it through an Alice in Wonderland perspective, which we're going to do first, and then I'm sure we're going to move off onto another tangent like we did in Coraline, because that's just what we seem to do on this show. So in terms of Alice in Wonderland, it wears its influences on its sleeve, right from the moment where Neo's asleep, or at that point, Mr. Thomas Anderson is asleep on his keyboard, and he's told to wake up and follow the White Rabbit. From there, it wears the influences. You mentioned before we jumped on the recording about Morpheus very, very explicitly saying so to Neo, that you're Alice and you're coming down the rabbit hole, and he's got the choice of the red pill and the blue pill. So the influences are there with Alice in Wonderland, but tell me a little bit more about what you think the influence is from Alice to The Matrix.
Well, I suppose the whole idea, the brilliant thing about Alice in Wonderland was that you can't really see the seams between what's real and what's imagined. The shift from Alice on that warm summer day to all of a sudden following the White Rabbit is so seamless that it's almost like reality and fantasy are existing side by side, which is wonderfully influential move from Lewis Carroll. And it kind of applies to The Matrix as well, because appropriately enough, it's like, you know, what if all we see and seem is but a dream within a dream, I believe is how the quote goes. I might have mispronounced that, but it's kind of like the idea being that, you know, that reality actually is a fantastical construct. And I think that's what Alice in Wonderland does. Alice in Wonderland presents you with a situation where everything is tweaked either overtly or covertly. There's a Tea Party, but it's run by the Mad Hatter. There's a cat that's a Cheshire Cat, and everything has been kind of turned on its head. And I think The Matrix takes that brilliantly. The idea that you can morph an apparently physical existence out of all proportion, but obviously they can only do that in The Matrix once they're aware of the actual state of things, which is once they've been taken out of the system and then plugged back into the system again, which is obviously a very, very Y2K theme, which is occupying pretty much all sci-fi techno-babble films around that point. It wasn't necessarily unique to The Matrix. Lots and lots of films were doing that around that point, which is obviously decidedly not Alice in Wonderland. Is it updated?
No, but I think there's that scene where Joe Pantoliano's character is sat meeting with an agent.
Cypher, yeah.
You know the character name. Well done. So he's sat there and he's talking to an agent. And he specifically says that, I know that this doesn't taste of anything, but it's the Matrix telling my brain that this is what it tastes like. So it's that awareness of the fact he is in the dream and that he wants to go back to being in that dream continuously. So he wants to stay there and what he's willing to trade for it. And I thought that that conversation was heavily influenced without referencing, whereas some of the other heavily influenced specifically reference the source of Alice.
Well, I suppose the pivotal moment is the first moment where you realise that the fabric of Neo's life is nothing more than a fantastical construct, when he's plugged in, and then all of a sudden he reaches out to the mirror and it comes off in his fingers, and then it gets all gloopy, and then it spreads down his arm, and then you actually get that down the throat shot, which is almost like a rabbit hole.
He's also gone through the looking glass.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well. Yes, yeah.
See, metaphors.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. It's lots of metaphors. Yeah, but I suppose, I mean, that puts a kind of like body horror spin on it as well. I mean, there is a lot of body horror in The Matrix. There's a lot of David Cronenberg. There's a lot of emphasis on flesh with wires and sockets and ports on it. And the idea that the rabbit hole in this instance is one's own throat, and then all the liquid kind of pours down into it, and then he wakes up in the real world essentially as a battery covered in like almost ambiotic fluid.
Yeah,
and amniotic.
Yeah, it's a complete rebirth, isn't it? He's then it's awakening, and then when he's sort of picked up and carried out, he's carried out in a Christ-like way.
Yeah,
and this is also, I've written essays on this in university.
I can never tell.
interestingly, right at the beginning of the film, right after he's been told to follow the White Rabbit, the hollow book that Neo picks up is where he's got all the floppy disks and stuff, because, you know, it's 1999.
I remember doing my coursework on those. That's how old I am.
And he opens the book and he hands the floppy disk to the guy. The book that he is opening is Simulacra and Simulation by a sociologist called Baudrillard. Mm. I think Jean Baudrillard. And the book as a whole is about the simulacra, which sort of have no original because they've been copied so many times. So if you think, for example, that I copy and paste something onto a memory stick for you, then delete the original, that then is the simulacra, because it's the copy of the original and then the copy of the copy and whatever. And obviously the simulation being the imitation of a real world process, something over that. So just the way that these things change over time. So it just shows that every single aspect of this film has been so painstakingly thought through and been made to be relevant. Even the book that he puts his floppy disks in is completely relevant to the theme of the reality versus the dream. So, and that's where I think the Wachowskis that possibly don't get as much credit as they deserve throughout their film. Again, I'm going to use the word again. I'm going to use oeuvre. their filmography. Yeah. Because, you know, they construct things to within an inch of their life, both to the positive and the negative. And every aspect has been thought through.
Well, it's weird, isn't it? Because The Matrix is a relatively disciplined movie, and the movie they did before The Matrix called Bound, which was a really good movie, was a disciplined movie. And yet you look at everything after The Matrix, it goes absolutely Doolally. It's almost like they throw everything in there, but they completely forgot about the coherence. I mean, you look at the Matrix sequels, you look at Jupiter Ascending, like, hang on.
Jupiter Ascending is very good fun.
You know, actually, Jupiter Ascending isn't actually that bad, even though it does have Channing Tatum as a half wolf, half man on hover boots, which is just utterly crazy.
Just whilst trying to date Mila Kunis.
Yeah, exactly.
Because of course.
Yeah, because she likes dogs and she's attracted to them. What on the hell was going on here? Like, you know,
at least that was fun. Cloud Atlas was a bit more noodly.
No, see, I like Cloud Atlas, and I think, you know, if we're talking about the Alice in Wonderland connection and the idea that, you know, going down through the rabbit hole and, you know, reality becoming fantasy and fantasy becoming reality, certainly Cloud Atlas touches on that surreal nature of everything seemingly being a dream, that we are all one big joint conjoined soul. And the idea of rebirth through time and reality can often seem very, very strange and very frightening. Like, there might be Alice in Wonderland comparisons to be drawn with Cloud Atlas, actually thinking about it. But no,
possibly. I mean, are you sure that's what was going on? Because I'm not sure that's what was going on.
Have you read the book?
No.
I watched the film and sort of
got confused.
It's a very, very difficult book to adapt, and I think they did an admirable, if flawed, attempt at it.
I've heard, but isn't it like 800 pages?
No, it's not that. It's not that long, and the book is actually really accessible, I think. I love David Mitchell's work, but we're getting off. We're getting off topic.
I have the book downstairs, and who knows, we may include that on a future episode of this podcast, because hey, we might just revisit this theme with some other films, because there's been plenty influenced by Alice.
Can I just say, if you're going to read a David Mitchell book, though, Black Swan Green is his most normal and grounded book, and definitely his best. That's the one I would recommend. So,
okay,
just throw that out there.
Yeah, I thought he was great in Webb as well.
Yeah, it's, ha ha ha.
I knew you were going to hate that. Yeah. I was going to say Peep Show, but I thought better.
Yeah, it's going to be too obvious, wouldn't it?
I thought it would annoy you that little bit more if I picked Mitchell and Webb look.
Yeah, yeah.
But back to The Matrix. And you referenced the sequels, which I think is probably best left there. But, you know, with the news of Matrix 4 coming, do you think that there's anything they can do in this world to match this first film?
Well, for one thing, it's not the Wachowskis. They're not doing it, both of them anymore, are they? It's just Lana Wachowski, I think, isn't it? So I don't know what the intention is. Well, I mean, we don't really know anything about it yet. I mean, given that The Matrix wasn't backwards in coming forwards in referencing everything from, you know, COD philosophy to Alice in Wonderland to Kung Fu movies, I'd be very surprised if there wasn't an element of all of those things in there. That's kind of what The Matrix was, wasn't it? It was a stew of these great big, you know, bold ideas, many of which had been covered before. But, you know, it was the fact that so many of these ideas were being put side by side together in a big populist blockbuster.
Yeah, that's the thing. They introduced a lot of ideas to a Western audience.
Yeah.
So you look at the things like the bullet time and the kung fu kind of action. So even that opening scene where Trinity, when she first does that kung fu kick and the camera stops and sort of spins around her, that is probably the first time a lot of people would have seen anything like that, because at that point people weren't as familiar with the films as John Woo as they are now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it was augmented by, like you say, by those camera moves, which were groundbreaking. We take that for granted now, the whole bullet time thing, but back then that was truly brilliant. And then you've got Hugo Weaving going, "Mr. Anderson," like that.
I wondered how long it would take for you to do a Hugo Weaving impression.
Yeah, he goes, "I look forward to watching you die, Mr. Anderson." He's great in that.
He's almost great in everything.
Yeah,
let's
he is.
Be completely honest here.
Yeah. He is actually. Yeah, he's a terrific actor. Yeah, and he's terrific. And he is the almost the fantastical antagonist of The Matrix, much in the way that the, you know, the Red Queen is in Alice in Wonderland, the person that might prevent you from getting further. and you know the terrifying aspect of it. But yeah, terrific performance from him.
Yeah, I think he's one of those actors who'll never, a film will never open on the strength of Hugo Weaving's name. Mm. That's where I've said something and it'll come back and bite me in future years. But, you know, you look at something like V for Vendetta, where he played the lead and title character. It wasn't sold on the strength of Hugo Weaving. It was sold on the strength of V and Alan Moore's book and Rise Up and what have you. But he's one of those actors that will always make a film probably about 30% better just by the sheer fact he's in it. So even Transformers is made better by the fact he's in it.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which is just utterly wonderful. It's so much fun.
Yeah, but I chose Transformers.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
Just to make the point that even in the worst film, he makes it 30% better.
I mean, you can't really tell it's him in Transformers. Everything is so horribly processed and industrialized and noisy. It's impossible to tell that it's him. It's just, Leonard Nimoy was the voice in one of them, wasn't he? I didn't even realize until the end credits. I was like, that was Leonard Nimoy? I was like, what did they do to him?
I honestly don't know. I stopped watching them.
It's a good idea. It's a good policy. Yeah.
However.
Yeah.
Moving back to our theme and our point, let's move this juggernaut around. I think The Matrix as a whole is just a groundbreaking, big, intelligent action blockbuster that, frankly, still holds up 21 years on, which can't be said for a lot of action blockbusters, because when something's as reliant on its special effects as The Matrix is, I think it's quite surprising that it does still last. Like, you can watch films from 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, and sort of go, ooh, those effects don't look so great. You can even watch Rogue One, the Star Wars Rogue One, and go, ooh, yeah, those effects don't look so great. So the fact it's held up as well as it has, both thematically, narratively, and visually, is actually something to really celebrate and encourage people to watch it again. I'm sure most people that have listened to this have already seen it. I would hope so. but if you haven't, just go and watch it. And go and watch it again.
The reason why I think a lot of films from that period, and yeah, you're right to single out The Matrix, the reason why they work in terms of their effects is because the effects were so much more limited back then, and they had to be so much more strategic in terms of how they use them. And it was a question of how do the effects serve the story, not the other way around, because CGI wasn't as standardized back in 1999 as it is now. And they had to mix and match that a lot more with sets, with practical effects, with animatronics. I mean, to an extent, that did start to change in 1999 after The Matrix with The Phantom Menace, which was just a gaudy, horrible monstrosity of a movie that just...
And wasn't Sky Captain and the Sea World of Tomorrow?
Yeah.
That was the first film completely shot on green screen or something like that.
I mean, I would say that had a sense of style to it. I'd say that was, you know, that had a sense of panache, although it might not necessarily have been a great film. But the thing was with The Matrix, they were spinning a great story. It was a great yarn that owed itself a lot to Alice in Wonderland and a myriad other sources. And there is real intelligence going on in The Matrix. And they really ambitiously pushed the concepts as far as they could go, astonishingly so for 1999. Again, given that CGI was in a relatively more crude form than it is now. I mean, obviously we'd had things like Terminator 2 and Titanic and Jurassic Park, but it wasn't so good that they could rely on it, certainly not to the extent that they could in the sequels. And maybe that explains why the sequels aren't as good as the original, because it's overload. It's complete overkill in the sequel, and the sequences where you see people flying in the sequels, it's like, oh no, it looks awful. And they completely lose the narrative thread as well. They lose the whole Alice in Wonderland connection. They lose all of the philosophy, all of the spirituality, and it's just like, oh goodness me. Just in spite of the fact that they talk about that a lot more in the sequels, they make a bigger deal out of it, but they talk more about it, but they say less about it, which is really, really peculiar.
Yeah, I think the sequels were very reactionary, weren't they? I think that they had the idea of roughly this is the world, and sort of moving forward from there, they didn't really know where they wanted to. They wanted to tell this sort of Christ-like fable, this parable of the One, and sort of how they would do that and how they would put that across to more films became, I guess, a little bit strained, shall we say.
Yeah. It's being polite.
I mean, there's certain bits that are good in the sequel. So you look back at the... I haven't watched this for years, but when you look at... I think it's in Matrix 2, when you've got Neo fighting all of the agents... That was a really cool scene
for the time it was. Have you watched it again recently?
No, this is why I gave it the caveat.
The CGI is not good. It's not good. Okay. It's really poor compared to in the first one. Again, the reason why it works in the first one is because there wasn't as much of it, and therefore there's less to notice about how dated it is. Whereas the second and third ones put all that front and center, and it's like, ooh,
right,
yeah. Okay. Sorry.
I'll bow to your knowledge.
I'll come down off my box.
I'll bow to your superior knowledge of having watched it in the last, I don't know, 15 years. Yeah. So, right. That will just about do us for this week's Frame to Frame. And next week's theme is going to be showmanship in the 1800s. So we'll announce the films as we normally do on our Twitter page and our Instagram pages on Friday. If you want to follow us on Instagram, that is frame_2_frame250. And on Twitter, we are frame2. So that's frame2frame with the number 2. So we hope you can join us next week to find out on those films and see what we talk about. I think it's going to be a good one because I'm not sure both of us will agree on both films. But anyway, in that case, I'm Andy Williams.
I'm Sean Wilson.
And we'll see you next week. Thank you very much.